This is the Tax Update Podcast for November the 3rd, 2008. This week, S-Corporation debt and how to not end up with basis. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CV presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners to subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. We stay on the same basic issue that we talked about last time, except this time we don't look at new revised rules regarding S-debt, but this week we look at issues where clients got themselves into hot water using the standard old rules we've all been used to on S-corporation debt. We look this week at the tax court decision in the case of Russell versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2008-246, where the taxpayers involved, there were two couples that owned S-corporations and other businesses, managed to demonstrate multiple ways to be effectively on the hook for debt, but still be unable to use that debt to claim an S-corporation loss. Now, the basic ability to claim a loss from an S-corporation depends on having sufficient basis in stock or debt to claim the loss. In Section 1366(d)(1), we find the general rules for limiting the deduction of losses. The provision begins by letting us know that the loss allowed for a shareholder for the year cannot exceed the sum of two items. The first of these involves the stock of the company held by the shareholder, and that limit is defined as A, the adjusted basis of the shareholder's stock in the S corporation determined with regards to paragraph 1 and 2A of Section 1367A for the taxable year. As noted, we find the general rules for stock basis in Section 1367A, noted in that section. However, unlike a partnership, the basis in the ownership interest is not increased by the taxpayer's share of debt of the S corporation, even if that individual may be fully recourse on that debt as far as the shareholder is concerned. They may be fully liable, have no right of reimbursement if they pay off on the guarantees. Rather, in the S corporation context, we look toward debt from the shareholder to the corporation only for purposes of getting basis. The definition of that debt is found in Section 1366(d)(1b). And that tells us that the shareholder's adjusted basis of any indebtedness of the S corporation to the shareholder, determined without regard to any adjustment on paragraph 2 under sections 1367B for the taxable year, limiting our losses. The key issue is that debt must be from the S corporation to the shareholder. No other debt qualifies. The case law makes it clear that being close, even if you claim economically it looks like the same thing as if the shareholder, as if the S corporation owed the debt to the shareholder, is not going to count for these purposes. That means get debt guaranteed by the shareholder or debt that is from another entity the shareholder controls, or even debt that the shareholder signs on as a co-maker of the note with, will not qualify for purposes of generating basis. In today's case, we see a couple of different ways that the taxpayers managed to foul up handling the debt to the corporation that created a problem with them for basis. The case involved two couples, the Russells and the Kopsings, who resided in North Dakota and had interest in a number of entities. The key one of interest in this case is the S corporation known as Missouri River Royalty Corporation, an S corporation until it terminated that election voluntarily effective September 1, 1997, when its shares were transferred by those shareholders to United Energy Corporation in a transaction that qualified under Section 351. United Energy Corporation consolidated a lot of the holdings of these two shareholders into now a unified entity that would file. Interest in other businesses were transferred as noted at that time. The tax court noted that nothing in the documentation of these 351 transactions discussed assumptions of debts to the shareholders as part of this transaction. There were a number of notes involved in the transaction, and the court gives us the facts dealing with each of them in order. The first set of notes they called the BNC notes. And Missouri River Realty Corporation, the S Corporation, borrowed funds directly from BNC in the first note in question. The tax court outlines the inception of that loan. On or about August 16, 1996, that's just about a year before they killed the S election, BNC National Bank lent $1 million to MRRC, that's the acronym for our corporation here, Missouri River Royalty Corporation. MRRC used the proceeds of the loan to pay off certain prior loans that had been incurred to purchase and rework oil wells. In consideration for the loan, MRRC gave BNC a promissory note for $1 million, what they call the MRRC note in this case, and entered into a loan agreement. In early 1997, well before the election was terminated, the loans were reworked. The revised loans are as noted below. On January 3, 1997, BNC canceled that original MRRC note in consideration for one, a $463,968 promissory note, which Mr. Russell co-signed, and which the court called the MRRC/DR note, and a $463,968 promissory note, which Mr. Compson co-signed, the MRRC-LK note, as the court referred to it. Mr. Russell and Mr. Compson also indicated they intend to guarantee the MRRC-DR and the MRRC-LK note, and the court noted that they did execute such guarantees. The notes were both listed MRRC as a borrower and indicated that they were for renewal of the MRRC note. The court notes that all payments on this loan through the September 1st, 1997 effective date of the 351 incorporation transaction were actually made by MRRC. On September 3rd, the balance of the note was paid off by MRRC, that's 2 days after the S election was effective, and all interest that was due at that time was reported on a consolidated tax return for the entity for the newly formed parent corporation. None of the interest for these notes was ever reported on the individual tax returns of the individual shareholders, so they didn't report interest income on these notes, nor did they report paying the interest on these notes. The next debt is what's called the Russell and Kopsig Ledger debt. That debt is a debt of the type we talked about last week, essentially an open account debt. The court notes that before April 5, 1996, Mr. Russell made a series of cash advances to MRRC, which MRRC used for working capital, the Russell Ledger debt. As of April 5, 1996, the principal balance of these advances totaled $562,705. In MRRC's books, the Russell Ledger debt was recorded as a liability in a ledger account entitled Notes Payable Russell, the Notes Payable Russell account. On October 5, 1996, MRRC issued a $562,705 note to Mr. Russell for the Russell Ledger debt. As of September 1, 1997, the principal balance of the Russell Ledger debt was $65,527. A similar loan account existed for Mr. Kopsing, as noted below. The court notes that before August 5, 1996, Mr. Kopsing made a series of cash advances to MRRC, which MRRC used for working capital. This became the Kopsing Ledger debt. As of April 5, 1996, the principal balance of these advances totaled $611,144. In MRRC's books, the Kopsing Ledger debt was recorded as liability in a ledger account entitled Notes Payable Kopsing. On April 5, 1996, MRRC issued a $611,144 note to Mr. Kopsing for the Kopsing Ledger debt. As of September 1, 1997, the principal balance of the Kopsing Ledger debt was $117,438. The court then goes on to describe these two notes in more detail. The Russell Ledger debt and the Kopsing Ledger debt were demand obligations. Interest on the Russell Ledger debt and the Kopsing Ledger debt was calculated using monthly compounding. There was no requirement that interest accruing on the Russell Ledger debt and the Kopsing Ledger debt be paid at least annually. The next debt in line is what's called the REMC note, that because Rainbow Energy Marketing Corporation, which was another entity controlled by Mr. Russell and Kopsing, was loaned money to the corporation. Now, this REMC was also involved in the Section 351 transaction, which our S Corporation was entered into. It also became owned by the holding company. This entry involved for this loan, loaning money to MRRC. The court began by noting REMC lent MRRC $57,000 April 1st, 1996 and $37,000 April 11th, 1996. REMC ledger debt. MRRC used the REMC debt for working capital. In MRRC's books, the REMC debt was recorded as a liability in a ledger account entitled Notes Payable Kopsing Russell Partnership. The REMC ledger debt was a demand obligation. There was no requirement that interest accruing on the REMC ledger debt be paid at least annually. A note was prepared in connection with the REMC ledger debt, the REMC note. The REMC note stated in part that effective April 1st, 1996, Missouri River Royalty Corporation promises to pay Copsing-Russell Partnership, 94,000 interest rate of the applicable federal rate. Interest on the REMC ledger debt was in fact calculated at a rate that varied from the Wall Street Journal prime rate plus 1% to the Wall Street Journal prime rate plus 2%. Interest on the REMC ledger debt was calculated using monthly compounding. At all times, the rate used to calculate interest on REMC ledger debt exceeded the short-term monthly compounding applicable federal rate as in effect. There was no requirement that interest accruing on the REMC ledger debt be paid at least annually. Note the quirk here. While we had a written note that told us the terms and the interest rates which we would pay, we didn't use that to actually compute the interest due. We, in fact, computed interest due using a rate tied to the Wall Street Journal prime rate with a varied change. That particular fact, as you might guess, is not going to necessarily be a good one for the taxpayers when they claim that that note should govern. Following the effective date of the S election, the S termination, the following entries were made on REMC's books. On June 30, 1998, an adjusting entry was made to MRRC's books, reclassified 22,042 of the 75,750 balance of the REMC ledger debt to notes payable Russell account and $53,708 of the balance to the notes payable Copsing account. The adjusting journal entry allocated the balance of the REMC ledger debt between the notes payable Russell account and notes payable Copsing account in proportion to the interest held by Mr. Russell and Mr. Copsing in REMC at the time the loans were made in April of 1996. What we have here is the accountant making journal entries here following the end of the year. It would appear likely that the point of these journal entries was to be able to claim what we really had here were loans from the individual members or the individual S Corporation shareholders to the S Corporation, even though it was originally recorded on the books as a loan from the other entity. Next, there is a short-term debt from another entity, the RGC Partnership, which is Rainbow Gas Company, a partnership owned by the two shareholders in the S Corporation. That partnership also became a part of the September 1st, 1997 Section 351 transaction incorporating, and then the shares are transferred to the new corporation. The court noted on this loan, the loans making up the short-term debt were transferred directly from the checking account of RGC Partnership to the checking account of MRRC. The repayments were transferred directly from the checking account of MRRC to the checking account of RGC Partnership. Before August 31, 1997, the short-term debt was recorded in MRRC's books as a liability in a ledger account entitled Notes Payable RGC. As of October 31, 1997, an adjusting entry was made to MRRC's books, reclassified that $561,298 of the short-term debt to notes payable Copsing account and $568,298 to the notes payable Russell account. It's probably not coincidental that this transaction is recorded on the books as taking place the day before the S election was killed. The court goes on to describe the note documents. With respect to each of the, note, of the loans comprising short-term debt, four notes were prepared. One from Mr. Russell to RGC Partnership, a Russell RGC note. Two, one from Mr. Copsing to the RGC Partnership, the Copsing RGC note. Three, one from MRRC to Mr. Russell, the MRRC Russell notes. And four, one from MRRC to Mr. Copsing, the MRRC Copsing notes. The face amount of each note was half of the amount transferred from RGC Partnership to MRRC on the date of the respective transfers. After giving this note, it balances, of course, and goes on to describe the terms of those notes. Each of the short-term notes bore an effective date, which was identical to the date on which the corresponding loan was made to MRRC. Both Mr. Copsing and Mr. Russell signed each of the short-term notes, either in individual capacities or on behalf of RGC or MRRC, but none of the signatures were dated. The short-term debt was a demand obligation. Each short-term note stated that it bore interest at interest rate at the applicable federal rate. However, and this is a refrain we saw from the last note, interest on the short-term debt was calculated at a rate that varied from the Wall Street Journal prime plus 1 to Wall Street Journal prime plus 2%. Interest on the short-term debt was calculated using monthly compounding. At all times, the rate used to calculate the interest on the short-term debt exceeded the short-term monthly compounding applicable federal rate that is in effect. There was no requirement that interest accruing on the short-term debt be paid at least annually. Again, we had actual actions that differed from what the notes claimed the actual interest accrual should have been. The payment record is described further by the court. On September 3, 1997, 2 days after the S election was killed, the $1,138,000 principal balance from the short-term debt along with accrued interest of $62,578 was paid by using a $1,201,175 cashier's check from MRRC to RGC. The $1,201,175 payment was reflected in MRRC's books by debiting notes payable Russell account for $569,298, debiting notes payable Copsing account for $569,298, and debiting the loan interest account for $62,578 with a memo notation, interest paid to Copsing and Russell for note. The $1,201,175 note was reflected in RGC's books by crediting notes payable Don Russell ledger account for $569,298, crediting the notes payable Lauren Kempsing ledger account for $569,298, and crediting the interest income account for the partnership entity, or what's now an incorporated entity, for $62,578 with the memo notation of interest on note receivable from MRRC. The $62,578 of accrued interest on short-term debt was reported on 1998 UEC Form 1120 as an interest expense of MRRC and interest income of RGC. None of that $62,578 was reported on Mr. Russell's 1997 Form 1040 or Mr. Kopsig's 1997 Form 1040, either as interest income or interest expense. Obviously, the key issue in this case is going to come down to which of these notes, if any, can the taxpayers use to deduct their losses, as there were significant losses in the S Corporation, and the taxpayers in question either had already or were going to exhaust their debt basis. Unfortunately for the taxpayers, in three of the four cases, the court held that the court agreed with the IRS that there was no basis in those particular notes for the shareholder to be able to use to take S Corporation losses. Let's talk about the problems with the debts. The court outlined first, based on prior cases, a number of factors that need to exist for an S Corporation shareholder to make use of debt basis. These are, first, a shareholder must make an actual economic outlay. And the court goes on to note that that means, per their opinion, the economic outlay must leave the taxpayer in a poor in a material sense in order for its bona fides to be represented. Second, the court note, the S Corporation's indebtedness must run directly to the shareholder. Specifically, the court observes that an advance from related pass-through entity will not be sufficient, nor will any indirect borrowing, including, the court notes, a guarantee, surety, accommodation, co-making, or otherwise indirectly making the loan to the S Corporation. Finally, the court notes that indirect loans and guarantees of that sort will only count at such time as the shareholder actually makes an advance against the loan. Prior to that time, there's only a theoretical liability of the corporation to the shareholder. Once the corporation has paid on the guarantee, then the shareholder does have a right to recover that payment from the corporation, so the debt exists then, but it does not exist prior to that point. As you can probably figure out, Mr. Russell and Mr. Kopsik ended up with some real problems with these tests. For the MRRC-DR note and the MRRC-LK note, the problem was that all that happened was shareholders guaranteed and were co-signers on a note from the corporation to the bank. But the corporation actually made all the payments. As is noted above, only if the shareholders had actually made the payments with the loans would there have been a debt from the corporation to the shareholders. At the balance sheet date, the corporation's direct debt was to BNC, and the corporation would only have been a liability to shareholders if it failed to make the payments. Therefore, no basis would be allowed. The REMC ledger debt was a different problem. It was a C corporation owned by the shareholders. The court quickly dismisses the journal entry, which is a favorite technique of outside CPAs trying to do after-the-fact cleanup on such a mess, by noting, although the REMC ledger debt was eventually reclassified in MRRC's books on June 30, 1998 as notes payable to Mr. Russell and Mr. Kopsig, the record is devoid of any evidence suggesting that this treatment was intended at the time REMC made the loans. Standing by itself, the adjustment of a journal entry several years after the actual transaction is insufficient to reclassify the source of a loan. Thus, even with this after-the-fact journal entry, there was still no basis. As is made clear, a journal entry is not going to be sufficient to get things cleaned up. What you have to be able to show if you're going to justify that journal entry is that it reflects what the intentions of the parties were at the actual time that the transaction took place. Rather, it's not just enough for you to come in after the fact and as a CPA say, oh, you guys shouldn't have done it this way. We need to have it done different. Needs to be done differently in order for you to get basis. That's fine. Should have been done differently. It wasn't. You have to demonstrate that, in fact, they had the intention of a direct loan at the time they did it. The court, in the next case, where we talk about this, where the court sides with the IRS, On the partnership loan, the IRS and the taxpayer, I should say, took different views of this. The respondent contends that short-term debt should be classified as direct loans. IRS contends that the short-term debt was a series of back-to-back loans from the partnership to Mr. Russell and Mr. Kopsig, and from Mr. Russell and Mr. Kopsig back to MRRC. So the taxpayers contended the latter. The taxpayers are contending that even though the checks went direct, we should treat them as if they went to the partners first and then the shareholders first, and the shareholders then loaned the money to the S Corporation. The court sided with the IRS view that there was a debt from the partnership to the S Corporation only, and that it would not treat it as bouncing through the owners. The court notes, the only evidence on the record supporting petitioner's characterization consists of, one, the short-term notes themselves, and two, the August 31st, 1997, adjusting journal entry in MRRC's books reclassifying the short-term debt. The four short-term notes have little probative value, as nothing in the record indicates that they were executed contemporaneously with the nine advances to MRRC. Although each short-term note bears an effective date which is identical to the date on which the RGC partnership made a corresponding advance to MRRC, Mr. Russell's and Mr. Kopsig's signatures on the notes are not themselves dated, and petitioners failed to present evidence indicating when the notes were executed. Petitioners' reclassification of the short-term notes on MRRC's books is insufficient by itself to prove the loan's origin. Same problem we had earlier. The reclassification occurred on the last day of MRRC's final tax year and only one day before the Section 351 transaction that incorporated and killed the S election, incorporated the new company, killed the S election when the shares went in. Petitioner offered no explanation for the timing of the reclassification. Not being contemporaneous with the actual advances, the adjusting journal entry cannot establish that the short-term debt constituted back-to-back loans at the time the advances were made. As well, the court takes note of the reporting of the interest, and that did not end up on the individual returns. Finally, the court notes, none of the interest paid on the short-term debt was included in gross income or deducted as an expense by Mr. Russell or Mr. Kopsing. For these reasons, the short-term debt is best characterized as a series of loans from RGC Partnership to MRRC. The issuance of the short-term debt did not constitute an economic outlay by MRRC shareholders and did not create basis in MRRC stock. The catch in this one being that in this particular case, details count, and having your form correct is hugely important. We couldn't just say at the back end, well, it should have been this transfer and this is how we should handle it. Rather, there's no evidence anyone ever really considered it that way. And frankly, our own books and records work against us because it's clear they're recording it and reporting it as if it was made directly from the partnership. As we have noted in past podcasts, a loan from a partnership owned by the shareholders of the S Corporation to the S Corporation does not create basis. The Ruckreigel case, you may remember that we discussed in a prior podcast, specifically dealt with that particular problem. Same issue here. Only the informal open account debt was granted basis. And in that case, the IRS conceded at court that there was basis. The court notes, respondent concedes that the Russell Ledger debt and the Kopsig Ledger debt constitute indebtedness of MRRC to Mr. Russell and Mr. Kopsig for purposes of Section 1366 D1B. Interestingly enough, remember that those were the notes they had written up and the advances they were doing in a more informal manner. The hitch becomes, even though those were informal, they were clearly from the shareholders of the corporation, and the court agreed and allowed those to be treated as basis. Unfortunately, they were a lot smaller than the other notes we were dealing with for the most part. What are our lessons from this case? Well, an important lesson from this is that for clients to understand the way that S Corporation debt involves some very strict bright line rules that don't appear to go along with economic reality. Clients need to understand they can't just make this work the way they think it should. And clients have to be very careful about how they handle debt issues. You have to carefully explain to clients that there are unique rules, and if they're going to be able to take debt losses against debt, that debt has to come directly from the shareholder to the S Corporation, and directly means directly. It should bounce through their personal bank account if at all possible. You should not transfer advances from related entities directly into the S Corporation, otherwise you risk the problem we have here where the debt's not going to be deemed to be theirs. Similarly, after-the-fact fixes by the CPA don't work very well either. It certainly appears in this case that somebody down the line tried to fix things up and redocument things to give these taxpayers basis. And as you note in the case, it simply didn't work. The other big problem with such after-the-fact fixes, actually there are a couple of them, but one big problem is, even if you can justify them and come up with some reason why you have reasonable basis for the position, or maybe even you're going to claim you have substantial authority, and you're going to be able to sign the return with that position on it, the problem you run into is the client then gets the message that, oh, that's no big deal because the accountant can simply fix it at year end with a journal entry. That continues for a number of years, and suddenly when we're under exam, the IRS then makes a big fuss about it. Now, I know a lot of CPAs are going to be thinking, and many of you may be thinking, well, it's not such a big deal, and if I go to the client with this, they're just going to complain, and they're going to say it's too much work and too much bother. My take is this. If it's too much bother, you're going to find they really don't believe it would have been too much bother to do it this way after they discover that had they done it correctly, that it would have been no tax, and now the IRS is sitting there with an assessment. Finally, we have the more general issue here that CPAs need to be concerned about, or anybody else who's a tax preparer needs to be concerned about, under Section 6694. We have to decide whether there is any evidence to support any sort of reclassification we might want to do to help out the client. If a CPA or any other tax professional does that, well, for a CPA, you have the problems of, and for other tax professionals, Circular 230 and Section 6694, CPAs also have the problems of the Statements on Standards for Tax Services for return positions. By issuing and by making this correcting entry when, in fact, there's no evidence to back it up, we are arguably not complying with any one of those three levels of standards and have potential exposure to disciplinary action or fines. It could be very difficult to explain the authority beyond just the journal entry, where there appears to be no independent evidence to support the idea that these individuals truly intended for this to be a loan from the individual shareholders to the corporation. Coming up this week, I'm going to actually be in Boise, Idaho, of all places, to show up to do a, because I've never been to Boise before, so I get to go there this week. We're going to do a presentation there on construction contractors, accounting, and tax issues. I'm also going to be at the Arizona Tax Institute this week. We're going to talk at the Arizona Tax Institute about Federal Tax Institute as a about the issue of the exposure to 6694 and other similar penalties. We'll be talking in that realm. The following week, I'm scheduled to do a date on the Tuesday of the following week in Reno, Nevada, a session on the practitioner's tax alerts, updates of changes in the tax law over the past year. And I'll be going to do an in-firm presentation in Sacramento on Thursday, so I have a little bit of road trips coming. The following week, I end up going around, I have an in-firm presentation in Delaware, and in a firm, a presentation in Cleveland for the construction contractors, and then following that, we're going to be doing some sort of program, it appears, in Columbus, where I'll be doing a tax update on what will be a shorter four-hour program put on by the Ohio Society. Following that, I pick up the second session for the year of the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference. And that'll take us pretty much up to the Thanksgiving week. I don't go anywhere that week. After that week, I go back to Ohio for a set of now scheduled for three courses, followed by the Oklahoma Tax Institute, where we'll talk about technology updates there. So I've got a number of presentation dates coming up. If you're able to make one of those for the state societies, be sure to sign up and I'll see you there. This has been the Tax Update. As always, it's brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to consider visiting there and signing up for their newsletters of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.